This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Vegetables live in oppression, served on our tables each night. This killing of veggies is madness. I say we take up the fight.
Good day.
Guten Tag.
Dude. Welcome to I Read the News Today, Oh Boy.
Or IRTN for short.
That's Stephen Benedetti. He's a permanent resident in Munich, Germany, where American liberalism is center-right politics.
And that was Matt Adams. He's both a Canadian and an American, which you can usually tell from both his accent and his attitude.
And today we're going to be talking about the attacks on democracy in Canada, otherwise known as the elections, and the attacks on Mr. Bin Laden, otherwise known as what? We don't know. We're going to debate that.
But before any of those topics, we're going to go to our regular feature, news you might have missed, Below the Fold.
So, in all the crime capers and law TV shows that I have sat through, I have never learned that one way to get yourself some money fairly quickly and easily is to deposit other people's checks. A CBC report by Kathleen Tomlinson documented how some owners of a condominium in British Columbia had for years given money to their treasurer to pay various bills, and the treasurer simply deposited the money into his account at the credit union Van City. Now, how did the treasurer do this? How did he deposit over $50,000 over 10 years into his account checks that were not written to him? Was it master forgery? Nope. Awesome disguise? Nope. Bribes or kickbacks? Nope. He deposited them. See, banks and credit unions apparently don't check the names or signatures on checks deposited in ATMs. Now, I'm quoting here from the story. Van City told CBC News it is standard practice for Canadian banks and credit unions not to verify or even look at payees' names, signatures, or endorsements on checks deposited through ABMs. Unquote. Yes, they don't check checks. And pursuing legal recourse for checks, especially more modest ones, can be costly and cost prohibitive. So I wonder what exactly those ATM fees are paying for then.
At the time that we are recording this, May 12, 2011, I'm pretty comfortable saying that everyone listening has heard that Osama bin Laden has been shot and killed. As the death itself transpired, Obama and many members of his staff gathered in a White House meeting room and followed the progress together. A photo was taken, which has already been determined to be iconic. It shows Obama leaning forward with a very serious expression, and Hillary Clinton with a hand over her mouth and her eyes wide open. Well, at least to most of us it does. A Hasidic newspaper published in Brooklyn photoshopped out both Hillary and the only other woman in the original photograph, Audrey Thomason. The newspaper offered the following apology for deleting the Secretary of State and the National Director of Counterterrorism from the newspaper photo. So, quote, "In accord with our religious beliefs, we do not publish photos of women, which in no way relegates them to a lower status. Because of laws of modesty, we are not allowed to publish pictures of women, and we regret if this gives an impression of disparaging to women, which is certainly never our intention. We apologize if this was seen as offensive." Well, I do appreciate them apologizing for the offensiveness of their religious beliefs.
They photoshopped the Secretary of State out.
That's just, and the National Director of Counterterrorism. You know, women.
Well, you know, writing a good lead in a news story, speaking of news stories, is a dying art. With 24-hour news cycles and the rush to be the first to get something out, who gets to spend time crafting an engaging start to a story that grabs the reader and demands that you read more? That's why here at IRTN, we are pleased to see Brian Hamacher of NBCMiami.com produce the following gem. And I quote, "Floridians are going to have to start pulling up their pants and stop having sex with animals soon." Unquote. Now that is a grabber. The folks at Daily Coast suggest that this is perhaps the best lead ever. It certainly is in the running. So the story is that not only does Florida have a new bestiality bill, it seems that the law's a bit lax in this front in Florida, but they also have the, and again I'm quoting, thank you Florida, quote, "droopy drawers bill," unquote. That means that students, quoting, caught showing their underwear or butt crack could face suspensions and other punishments, unquote. And some say journalism is dead.
You know, you can tell a lot about a society by the things they have laws against.
You certainly can. You certainly can, Mr. Foucault.
Two of my favorite topics rose to the surface like cream this week: Arizona and secession. There is an actual movement in Pima County, the large border county south of Phoenix, to secede from Arizona and make a 51st state. Tucson, Pima County's largest city, home to the University of Arizona and, just coincidentally, Arizona State University's graduate programs in public works and social work, has always been more liberal than Phoenix and the vast majority of the state. Now they are tired of having their lives controlled and influenced by the likes of Governor Brewer and a legislature that passes unconstitutional immigration laws, birther bills, and has a sheriff famous for violating prisoner civil rights. So they are beginning the long process of gaining independence from Arizona, creating Baja Arizona, and changing our flag forever. I don't think it's actually very likely to come about, and it won't even get onto a ballot until 2012, but should it come to pass, you heard it here first.
Well, it's going to be in the ballot?
They're trying to get it on the ballot. That's the earliest you can get on.
Well, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released a report just this last Monday, and it says close to 80% of the world's energy supply could be met by renewables by mid-century if backed by the right enabling public policies. The findings also indicate that the rising penetration of renewable energies could lead to cumulative greenhouse gas savings equivalent to 220 to 560 gigatons of carbon dioxide between 2010 and 2050. While the report concludes that the proportion of renewable energy will likely increase even without enabling policies, past experience has shown that the largest increases come with concerted policy efforts. And just to add a quick note there, the Conservative Party here in Ontario, the leader has come out in anticipation of the October election saying that he will, if elected, repeal these environmental incentive laws.
Nice.
Yeah.
Since 1995, Europeans of 22 different nations have enjoyed freedom of movement within the EU, but that is now coming under attack. Denmark, of all countries, has declared that they are reinstalling border checks at their land borders to Sweden and Germany in order to cut down on cross-border crime. This violates EU law signed into effect back in 1985 and, according to German news sources, is a severe case of right-wing populism. The Danes claim that this is not illegal because the law allows for reintroduction of border checks at times of serious threats to public safety or national security. This is my favorite bit. The example used to demonstrate an appropriate time to reintroduce temporary border checks is to prevent soccer hooligans from traveling to matches. Europe, you're so cute. Makes me wonder, though, if this is really the start of border checks throughout Europe, and if some American politician is going to start thinking about securing their own state borders from other states, in the interest of public safety, of course.
Nice. Well, that's below the fold news you might have missed.
Hey, Matt. How are things in Canada?
Things are a little crazy here, Stephen. We just had an election, as you know. And
I'm trying to remember what your prediction for the election was. Well, do you remember what that was, Matt? do we have a tape on that? Can we go back?
I'm sure we do, but I'm not going to. I said that I thought that there'd be a minority government but I also said anything could happen because the polling data is really shaky. And that there'd be a minority governed by the conservatives, and that there could be a coalition-ready opposition. But instead, we have a sizable majority government by the conservatives. The Liberal Party, which is a political institution in Canada, has been decimated. And the NDP, which has historically been a left party and is more like a center-left party now, practically tripled their seats. And the Bloc Québécois from Quebec, a huge amount of votes went over to the NDP, mostly, in my view, as a rejection of Harper, just trying to hold back a Harper majority, a conservative majority. So lots of crazy things happening, but at the end of the day, we have a conservative majority government, and in Canada, where there is severe party discipline, as I say all the time, unlike in other parliamentary systems, such as in England, that pretty much means they're ruled with an iron fist.
Yeah, you just in your description there, you used a really interesting phrase. You talked about them having a majority government, and you had a specific phrase about the amount of votes that they got. But you sent me a really interesting article about the vote spread, where I think it looked at the 14 closest elections and the total or the average number of votes that swayed it one way or the other, swayed it towards the conservatives, was like 800 votes per district in those 14 elections. It was a total of 6,000 votes for all of those. It's just amazing how razor thin this majority government is.
Yeah, I mean, it was a really good analysis done by Matt Peters, Ryan Bolt, which can be found at rabble.ca. But yeah, exactly 6,201 votes in 14 different ridings. And that would have had an effect on the election. One was 14 votes. And we're talking, yes, that's the combined, as you said, victory. And so in many cases, you had Liberal voters and NDP voters. People said splitting the vote. I don't think that is so clean. I think a lot of Liberal voters are fairly right-wing and, in fact, go to the Conservatives. But some of them do go to the NDP, and there is some vote splitting there. And there's a lot of talk about, oh, should the parties merge? And if they merged into some sort of center party, they probably would hold power. But then it'd be more center instead of center-left, in my view, or maybe barely center-left. But yeah, it's really, really close. And so this notion that it's this massive mandate just doesn't exist. As I keep hammering and hammering and hammering, we keep talking about it here, but when you've got 41.8%, I think that's the number of eligible voters not voting for the party in power, there's something wrong there. But it's a significant thing. They have significant power, and this is the way the election system works here, and they most likely won fairly, fair and square.
Yeah, that's an actually very interesting question, because anytime we have a close election in the states, one thing is massive amounts of people claiming voter fraud, and a second thing is people then either demanding recounts or having automatic recounts triggered. Are either one of these a factor in standard Canadian politics?
Well, we're seeing more and more of the dirty tricks. There was some here in Ontario and Guelph. There was reporting on election night of people getting calls saying that their polling station had been moved, things like that. I'm sure that there's been no report on who put those out. I'm sure there'll be plausible deniability, and I doubt very much charges will happen that will go above some rogue individual, and it'd be an interesting piece of investigative journalism to find out if you could trace that back to a party.
Does investigative journalism still live in Canada?
Well, as much as it lives anywhere else. One of the challenges of investigative journalism, of course, is it costs tens of thousands of dollars to do an investigative journalist story, and sales don't go up. And so newspapers and magazines have a disincentive to do it. But so in other words, nothing really formal has come out, and I doubt that. I mean, the margin is pretty big. You have to be, there's 305 seats in the Tories. The Conservatives have 167. So with 39.62% of the actual vote. But I think what we see here is there's a lot of people, especially progressive people, saying what does this mean? And there's people holding meetings and conversations. And at Rabble, there's a year-long sort of series examining sort of what does this mean, reflecting on democracy and commons. And we're seeing more and more of that. And there are rallies this weekend in major cities for electoral reform. Can we have more proportional representation? Because Canada remains one of the four or so countries in the world that doesn't have it. But the odds of that coming are extremely low. I mean, England just had a vote last week and it for some version of alternative voting, and that failed. And that would have been great if it had gone through. It would have been a real boost for Canada. I don't think we're going to see that.
And the other thing, recounts, what about – do you
there could be some recounts. There is a challenge. Some people are talking about challenging – you get $2. We were talking about this before we came on the air. All parties will pretty much run as many candidates as they can, even when they know they can't win, because there's some federal funding for parties. If you get a certain amount of votes, like you get $2 per vote, and so you'll run protest candidates. But unlike in the U.S., when you're voting for a congressperson, even if that congressperson is from a little small town somewhere, he or she could sit in a committee that has real actual power. Here, you could be some little backbencher, and you might have informal power within your caucus, but you're not necessarily going to be affecting huge pieces of legislation. And so they'll just run people. And one of the women that won, kind of controversially, you know, she had actually never been to the riding. It's predominantly a French-speaking riding in Quebec, and she doesn't speak very much French. She was actually in Las Vegas during the election. She didn't campaign at all. And then she won. And people are like, well, that's crazy. But it's not the same as, like, people were actually voting for the party in that case. They're voting against Harper, because they just wanted to not have Harper in power, and they didn't trust the Liberal Party to deliver, so they voted for the NDP or the Bloc. And so now there's this massive criticism. But to me, some of this is the mainstream media just attacking young politicians. Yeah, she was a protest candidate, but does that mean that she can't contribute, that young people can't contribute?
And not only that, it's just another example of the ineffectiveness of the Canadian political system, that can happen. Because, I mean, we had that Alvin Green guy in South Carolina in the last American elections, where, it sounds like the same sort of candidate, and he got nothing, because he was nothing. You know, he didn't campaign, didn't have a platform, barely appeared in public, and he can be put on the ballot, but he's not going to get elected. In this Canadian system, where you're not voting for the person, you're voting for the party, you can get this sort of thing. It's all tied up in what you keep going back to, the unfairness of the Canadian political electoral system.
Yeah, I mean, I think people have to – I suspect they weren't her top choice in terms of people as individuals, but they wanted to hold off Harper, so they had to vote for her. I'm not nearly in a tizzy like a lot of the sort of media mainstream are about some of these people that are inexperienced that are coming in with the NDP, because the NDP has a core of 30-some-odd people that have been there for years. And democracy is supposed to be about citizens. It's not supposed to be just lawyers and corporation leaders.
Right, and if you
coincidentally haven't done such a great job,
how are they going to get experience? You've got to get some new people in there.
Yeah, I'm glad to see some people in there doing some stuff. I would have preferred to see candidates everywhere that actually are from the riding that they are representing and can speak the language, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that is, as you said, is indicative of the system. And I think this criticism of having sort of young people just out of school or whatever, that they're somehow no good compared to what? Some CEO that bankrupted his corporation, or that, just because you have some high, official training doesn't make you any better at representing the constituents of people. So to me, that's a sort of profound elitism coming out that I'm not sure you'd see if they were so right-wing.
Right, exactly. And if you're going to fix the electoral system, that's like one of the last things you're going to get to. That's not the big problem, that some people without the greatest experience, maybe without the proper residency in terms of in some people's eyes, that those aren't the problems. The problems are, as you talk about again and again, is
ad nauseum, I think, is the word you're looking for.
Huh?
Ad nauseum, I think, is the word you're looking for.
Could be. The lack of proportional representation. I mean, it's a pretty simple concept, really.
Yeah, and they rule like kings. I mean, the big news is that they had a campaign pledge, the Tories, to have balanced budget surplus by 2014, 2015, and now a week out, they're like, well, that's not going to happen. Oh, well.
Oh, well, it's like the Republicans they got elected in 2010. It's a lot easier to campaign than it is to govern, and it's easy to go out there and say, yeah, we're going to reduce that deficit. Yeah, we're going to save Medicare. We're going to do this. And then you get into power and you got to produce the legislation that would actually get it done. You're like, oh, well, I can't actually get done.
Yeah, but in this case, they actually have a huge amount of power. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, there might be financial, you can't say, well, everything's going to be rainbows and puppy dogs. But again, in the U.S., you cross parties and there's deal making and kickbacks and pork. And by kickbacks, I mean, I know there's illegal kickbacks, but I mean more like favors. You vote for my museum and I'll vote for your bridge to nowhere, and we'll put it on this bill about a moon landing, and then the president won't veto it because there's all this kind of wheeling. And here it's more like, here's our deal, and now there's political pressure, and they can only go so far based on political pressure in the sense, but if Harper wants to go all in, if the Tories want to go all in, they can get a lot done and be willing to give up some seats. I kind of doubt they'll do that, but then the NDP are in this position where people are kind of taking them out for a test. They're just kind of dating for the first time because this massive amount of votes for them coming out of Quebec, and maybe if they aren't able to deliver some things to Quebec, they'll go elsewhere again. So who knows what's going to happen? It's very interesting times, and it would be great if it resulted in electoral reform. I'm feeling cynical about that, but I am excited to see that some that some action is happening, actual marches in the streets, largely led by young people. But we don't know the young vote. Who came out for the young vote? We don't know yet. A new study came out saying the young vote was huge, but the study is extremely flawed, actually. And so I don't trust it. McLean's was criticizing it. I mean, it only was surveying people on one website. And on that website, it was mostly an academic for university students, so it's skewed. And then it's self-identifying. Sample size was 800 people, blah, 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 blah. So we don't know yet the numbers, but we'll see.
Well, I'm going to try to put a rein on this a little bit, Matt, because we both know you could go on for a while and talk about the with both the election in general and specifically. Let me try to end it on a positive note for you. So with everything you're just saying, you're not actually seeing this then as like possibly the beginning of a permanent conservative majority government in Canada.
Probably not, because I think that in fact the conservatives' ideology and policy positions, public opinion polling show time and time and again that they are not the opinion of the majority of Canadians. And I think they, you know, obviously having power can shape opinion, but I think people will react to it more and more and more. It'll be less stealth than it's been, more blatant, I'm hoping, and maybe I'm being naive. That doesn't mean I don't think they can't hold on some power, but I think it's a chance for progressives and liberals to maybe actually begin to organize and develop some cohesive resistance.
Look at that. I got an optimistic statement out of you.
There you go. So let's move on then
to what is like possibly the biggest news in the world in the last week.
Yeah, it's possible to say that. I mean, even though it's very sort of U.S.-centric, it probably is the biggest news, the death of Mr. Bin Laden. And it's been talked about to death, as it were, but I think it's still worth talking about.
Yeah, well, you and I, we don't talk every day on this sort of forum, and so we kind of have to go back and review some things that have been already in the news for a while. So hopefully we won't be boring anybody too much. But there's a lot of interesting, angles on this, which I haven't really seen covered that much in any of the mainstream news. One of the big ones that you and I would start talking, I don't know if we want to start with this, the legitimacy of this attack, of this killing of Osama bin Laden, if this was legitimate. Was it legal? Was it a political assassination?
Yeah, I mean, and then we don't have all the facts. We probably won't always have all the facts, but it's beginning to come out a bit more. There's more and more people, some are on the right, and I don't really trust them because that's simply politically motivated. I don't think they really care about the rule of law, international law. In fact, they denounce it all the time. But people that actually care about the rule of law are saying, you know, if bin Laden was captured and secured under an act of war, then killing him is a murder. You can't kill a soldier that's been captured. You can't simply kill them. It's a violation.
Right. But then we go back again to the very idea that it was never declared a war, right? This is Bush's big defense.
Though bin Laden declared war. But yes. But even Greenlaw, even people like Greenlaw, you know, the constitutional writer and Solon is saying it's hard to tell what's going on there. But if there was a firefight and an exchange of fire over and in defense and you know, there's some sort of in-the-moment decision and they shot him, then that's something else. We don't know. But it would be nice. But people don't seem to care. And it was a campaign pledge for Obama that I will go there and I will capture him or I would kill him. And it's even being marked as those fact-checking places as, oh, yeah, fulfilled campaign promise.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's if you have an honest reaction that you can give when you heard the news. I would say I was more happy than anything else, maybe partly because it's done. We don't have to like keep worrying about bin Laden at this, not worrying about hearing about the and having this boogeyman that the right can always use again to decrease the liberties in the U.S. and et cetera, et cetera. And I was just like, you know what? Good. But I wasn't moved to party in the streets like a frat boy. I wasn't. I didn't have the feeling justice was done. That phrase did not occur to me. I didn't understand the reaction that I saw on CNN. I saw it on the internet as well. Literally treating it like a party, And I think I'm wondering if it's generational. I'm wondering if it's people that were born, let's say people 25 and younger, where the last 10 years with the global war on terror has been going on, is taking up more than half of their life, you know, of their conscious life, the things they remember. And it just, and it has a penetrating depth to them that it doesn't have for you and me. I don't know. I'm just throwing it out there. I was a little puzzled by my reaction and their reaction and the difference between it.
Yeah, I mean, my reaction was mostly, I think, I was concerned. It made me a bit frightened about how is this going to foment more terrorism and more attacks on people and civilians around the world in terms of, because that's largely how these kind of things work, you know, and it acts to sort of radicalize people. And, you know, what would our response be? Am I, you know, do I think the world, you know, obviously Bin Laden is a, you know, it's hard to come up with adjectives to describe him. You know, he's killed people all over the world. But it made me nervous. And then the celebration actually, in hindsight, should have been obvious to me, but I was caught off guard by it. It seemed, really? Like, this is your response, your sort of visceral response for people to go out and like you're saying, maybe just, you know, they were 9, 10 years old and this happened. There's been this thing, sort of like a sort of Hitler-like figure around, though in fact, he really wasn't, you know, the high strategy guy. But it's that sort of reaction. And then the reaction of some people, you know, people like Jon Stewart, who was very profoundly affected by 9/11 and has been very active. And he was there, ground zero, and, you know, in downtown. But I'm even a bit surprised by some of their sort of flippant jokes around how he was killed and shot. Like, even tactically, if you consider this person your worst enemy in the world, just dancing in the streets help you not create a new worst enemy in the world?
Yeah. Weren't there tons of people in the States complaining that Hamas, the Palestinians, were dancing in the streets when the Twin Towers came down, and what disrespect that is to the U.S. and they you know, these are therefore our enemies. This partying in the streets is the same thing. Where's the difference in that?
And then I read this great piece by Chris Hedges from Truthdig. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, and he speaks Arabic, and he was the Middle East bureau chief in the New York Times. And he said, just going to quickly read this. He said, "I was in the Middle East in the days after 9/11, as we garnered the sympathy of not only most of the world, but the Muslim world, who were appalled by what had been done in the name of their religion. And we had major religious figures like Sheikh Tanwahi." I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing that name. Tantawai. Apologize for that. "Who, after the attacks of 9/11, not only denounced them as a crime against humanity, but denounced Osama bin Laden as a fraud." And I think people forget that. And that, how does this feed into sort of just the radical fundamentalist wing and not support the people that were kind of saying, look, you know, we hate bin Laden. A lot of these places hate bin Laden. The Saudi Arabia government, they hate bin Laden because he terrorist acts in their countries. They hate him. So it's a tough call. And then, you know, a couple of days after that, I just want to briefly mention this. The U.S. went after Anwar al-Awlaki, who's
down
a U.S.
Yemen, right?
Yeah, who's a U.S. citizen. And they said, oh, yeah, we tried to kill him and we killed some civilians by accident, but he's a U.S. citizen. And, well, you know, the Constitution of the United States says you have to have a trial before you're put to death for treason. So now it's like, whatever. And so, I don't know. It concerns me.
In all that you said, the one thing that I have to say I didn't, it occurred to me briefly, but I really couldn't get myself worked up about it at all, was your idea that, is this going to create more terrorists? Will there be terrorist attacks as a result of it? Hey, you know what? If there's going to be terrorist attacks. They'll find a reason if they want to attack.
Yeah, there's always going to be terrorist attacks. That's true.
Right. And if there's one person in the world that I could, I'm okay targeting for a U.S. government-approved death, it was bin Laden, you know? But I'm still not that comfortable with it. But like I said, at the same time, I was like, yeah, okay.
But then what does it mean? Like today on CBC, they had Benjamin Fernandez, I think was his name, talking about how, you know, didn't the Nuremberg trials mean anything? And you know, that America had pushed for public trials, and many of the other countries, England and the Soviet Union, were pushing for just sort of, you know, executions. And we're saying, well, shouldn't we have something that says, you know, we capture our enemies and we give them open court and we beat them with our ideas in open court? Clearly, that doesn't mean anything anymore. And people say we're being naive and the world is different and everything. Well, then let's admit it, that we are what we denounced a mere short time ago.
Yeah, and now after reading these articles on what's justified in warfare and not, I understand why at the beginning they made a point of saying that I knew I was going to do it, that Osama was armed, that Bin Laden was
armed. Yeah, yeah.
That was like in the first reports he was armed, and then in the second reports he was armed and he had a human shield, and then it's like, okay, he wasn't armed, but he did have a human shield. Okay, he wasn't armed, didn't have a human shield, but the forces felt threatened.
Right, right. I mean, it keeps changing. But it's also interesting, there's this new report out of The Guardian saying that, in fact, Pakistan had set a deal with the United States 10 years ago, allowing them to come in and wink, wink, nudge, nudge, and that there's some WikiLeaks cables that imply that they've done that in the past. They denounced something publicly that they actually agreed on. But you were questioning sort of the validity of that article, perhaps on anonymous sources, or...
Yeah, there just didn't seem to be any backup whatsoever in the article itself. It's just like, there's a 10-year-old deal between the U.S. and Pakistan, obviously. And in it, it says that if it happens, Pakistan government will deny any knowledge of it and denounce the attacks. You know, anybody could write that about anything. And it's just, there wasn't any substantiation in the article itself. So...
All right, now you know what I want to do? I want to play the true-false conspiracy game. You have some conspiracy theories that you found about the death of Mr. Bin Laden.
I mean, to say I found them, I think this is a good way to end for today, though, really. But I didn't find them. They're out there. They're like, I'm not looking for these things, but it's just, you know, I just put it in a little.
But most of the you made up one or two of them, right?
I only made up one.
All right, but I don't know which one it is. So I'm gonna try to guess true or false. Like, these are ones he made up or not by true or false. They're true or false. Like, what's a better word? Made up, or they're all made up.
But only one of them did I just go
right. Crazier Steven. That's what it'll be called.
At some point, someone will come up with this. You
all
know?
Right, all right. So, Doug, tell me. Just do these in random order. Here we go.
Okay, but the problem with this, it's going to be no fun once we figure out which one was fake.
All right. Well, then we'll just read through the ones after I figure out. But I don't know.
Okay. Well, I'm going to start with the squirrel theory, which is that if you see the movie Up and the dog gets distracted by the squirrel, the raid was fake, and it was to distract us from the release of the president's obviously fake long-form birth certificate. Look, a squirrel.
I'm going with legitimate crazy on that one, because those are the same kind of arguments as the flypaper theory. Oh, we attacked Iraq because then the terrorists will all go there. Am I correct? Crazy? Genuine crazy?
That was genuine crazy.
Genuine Tea Party crazy. All right.
Then there was Obama. Like I said, this is both conspiracy theories and criticism. So it's both. It's not just conspiracy theories. Obama made a mistake in killing him and should have arrested him, but he was afraid to.
Yeah, well, I think there actually might be some truth to that. But for different reasons. So I'll put myself in the crazy pile.
You'll put yourself in the crazy pile with John Woo, the architect of the torture memos.
Yeah, well, John Woo, all of a sudden he's discovered the rule of law.
Yeah, it's nice, isn't it? Okay, well, we've got it's Bush's victory. The economy is no longer Bush's economy, but this action is a result of Bush's great and glorious pursuit of this evildoer.
Yeah, that's actually mainstream Republican argument. So I know that one, because he stopped blaming Bush for the economy. But Bush captured and killed Bin Laden. Yeah, I know that's genuine Republican talking point. So these are easier.
Okay. Then there's deathers. These are, of course, the people who want to know, how do we actually know he's dead? We're just going to deny the whole thing.
Yeah, that for sure is out there.
Okay. Then what I'm calling the Manchurian candidate deathers. The fact that Al-Qaeda confirmed the death only proves that Obama is in cahoots with them.
Huh. I'm calling bull on that. That's a Steven theory.
No, you got me.
I did, all right.
But I bet we're going to hear this. I bet we're going to hear it.
All right.
Not just from me.
Yeah. No, come no. That's your prediction. I like it. I like it. I think I think it's coming. If it's not out there already, it's coming. If someone else has spotted it, send it to IReadTheNewsTodayOhBoy@gmail.com.
And I just have two more. The long dead theory that Bin Laden's been dead for a long time and on ice since Tora Bora, basically. And they brought him out now just as a straight-up political move to increase the popularity.
See, I would have called bull on that, too.
Nope. That one's out there. And the last one is it has to do with the date that the raid occurred. In Washington time, it was still May 1st. And that's a sign to Obama's most Marxist brothers that he's on board with the party line.
Because it's May Day. Come on. Where did you see that?
Boy, I'll go look for it. I'll find it and I'll get it to you.
All right. Oh my goodness. All right. Well, that's amazing. That's amazing. Well, thank you for those conspiracy talking points here as we wrap up our episode of I Read the News Today. Oh boy.
And for once, it isn't a special holiday edition. It's just a standard everyday May 12th edition. That's me signing off from Munich, Germany.
And this is me signing off from Toronto, Ontario. Take care.
Bye bye, Matt.